On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In April 1966, the cover of Time magazine asked, "Is God dead?" Well, no, the answer turned out to be. Despite centuries of science, the Enlightenment's resistance to religious dogma, and modernity's romance with reason, faith has not only survived but made a huge comeback in recent years. Now, a raft of books, some bestsellers argue, again, that humans must get beyond religion to move forward, that fundamentalism and doctrine breed conflict and darkness. But could it be that despite the pullback of the religious right in recent U.S. elections, it is still science and reason that are in deeper retreat? Up next, On Point, Enlightenment values, religion, and who owns the future. We'll hear today from Sam Harris, tough critic of religion and author of the current bestseller Letter to a Christian Nation, and we'll hear from Princeton Don George Kateb. But first today, we turn to Richard Schwader, cultural anthropologist and professor of human development at the University of Chicago. His recent New York Times op-ed piece asserts that it's the Enlightenment story that's in trouble. Richard Schwader, thanks very much for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
So here we've got the big bunch of books out there lately from Richard Dawkins, who we've talked to on this show, with The God Delusion, Daniel Dennett, Breaking the Spell. We'll hear in this hour from Sam Harris, making sharp attacks on religion, saying it's time to get beyond it. You say the story of the Enlightenment is the one that's in trouble, the one that looks more illusory than real. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that ever since that period you mentioned in the 17th and 18th century, there have been predictions that in the modern world, religion would go away and be replaced by science. There were predictions that the tribes, the groups that exist, would go away and be replaced by individuals. And those predictions have repeatedly been wrong. This has not happened, and it will not happen, either globally or locally. Diversity is inherent in the human experience. There's going to be groups and factions always. James Madison, one of those founding fathers, was well aware of the existence of factions even at the time of the founding. And religion is not going to go away because reason alone can't fill the gap that is filled by revelation and by inherited social and cultural meanings of one type or another. There is a very large area of human understanding which I would call non-rational. It means it requires some act of faith. It requires a commitment to some kind of prior assumptions that neither logic nor scientific evidence can touch. I don't think we're going to have scientific evidence which is going to establish whether or not there's life after death, whether or not souls reincarnate, whether or not individual choice should be privileged over family honor. These are things that are discretionary. And human beings being what they are, they're going to make diverse, different decisions about those things and build ways of life around the assumptions that are the basis of their sacredness. So that's that in a, I think that the Enlightenment premise that the dictates of reason, that is logic and scientific evidence, provide a universal standard for making judgments of validity and worth is wrong. It can't take you all the way. Critical reason is obviously terribly important, and we should exercise it wherever possible. But the notion that reason requires the rejection of both religion and group loyalties or cultural attachments, and that anyone who believes in religion is somehow irrational, that religion is a measure of mass irrationality, I think is a mistaken Enlightenment position.
You put a lot on the table right there, but let me ask you about this. Here we've got a few centuries where, however uneasily sometimes, religion and reason have coexisted in an awful lot of societies, certainly in the American culture. So why not that continued coexistence? Well, I read you saying that, in fact, it's the Enlightenment story receding, the Enlightenment kind of values in retreat here. Why not the old coexistence?
Well, the coexistence is what I'm calling for. The Enlightenment story that I think is a mistake, that it's a myth, is the idea that in the modern world, in modern society, with education, religion will disappear because it's a form of irrationality. Groups will disappear because they require loyalties that have no basis in human rationality. That's what I think is waning, this notion that we're going to go from religion to pure science, from groups to a cosmopolitan world of individuals who relate to each other in a world of strangers, essentially, with no loyalties to in-groups versus out-groups and so forth. It's that that I think is on the wane.
So what do you make?
We should recognize it.
There's
going to be a coexistence. There always have been. And I think part of the Enlightenment mythology is to try and represent the Dark Ages as preceding the Enlightenment, as though people before the 17th century had no critical reason, didn't engage in scientific analysis, were not logical. We have these caricatures and lampooning of the past in which you imagine that before Columbus, everyone thought the world was flat, which is not true. You have one after another in post-Enlightenment mythology that says, we have arrived at the truth. Those who came prior were ignorant, confused, in error.
What do you make, then, of this spate of books from Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, from Daniel Dennett, from Sam Harris, who we'll hear from in just a minute, coming out right now, pushing very hard against religion in 2006?
I think it's an evangelical atheism that's there as a kind of counter to evangelical Christianity and certain forms of fundamentalist Islam. And I think that, you know, at the political level, there are a number of things that happened in our society, all the way from opposition to stem cell research to issues over what do you teach in schools about creationism versus Darwinism, to the international scene that have created, at one level, political contests that create populations of readers, especially in the secular enclaves of the world, who are eager for every possible argument they can think of to launch in their political battles against what they view as the enemy. However, I'm suggesting that there is a deeper anxiety, which is that the expectations of the late 20th century, that, for example, with the end of communism, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, all of a sudden everyone was going to feel liberated and were going to choose to move in the direction of the West is best image of the world, and American society in particular, has proved to be false. And even globalization has led to the reemergence of local groups, ethno-nationalisms of one type or another. So there is a lot of things going on in the world, which I would think would be a kind of evidence against the view that progress means individualizing the world, getting rid of groups. Progress means the end of religion, the adoption of science.
Richard Schroeder of the University of Chicago, please stand by. I want to welcome into the conversation, joining us from Santa Monica, California, Sam Harris. He's the author of The End of Faith. His current bestseller is Letter to a Christian Nation. Sam Harris, thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be back.
So you've been out talking a lot about religion and its downside. Now here's Richard Schroeder, and he's portraying you and Richard Dawkins and others in this vein as kind of with your backs against the wall, a kind of last-ditch defense of the Enlightenment. Is that how you see it?
Well, in large respect, I do. I mean, I disagree with many things that Richard just said, but I certainly agree that the Enlightenment is under siege and is incomplete and in some sense has never even started in the Muslim world. And so the Enlightenment is in peril in some sense, and that very much motivates me in the work I'm doing. I see this rather differently, though. I think that we get confused by the way we use certain terms like reason and religion, without really defining them precisely. I would argue that all of us acknowledge a very obvious distinction between believing things for good reasons and for bad reasons, a difference between knowledge and ignorance, a difference between knowledge and willful self-deception and wishful thinking. And we even religious fundamentalists acknowledge these differences in every area of their lives apart from religion, really. I mean, they make demands for evidence and cogent argument in making business decisions, in any terrestrial matter. And yet we have inherited this double standard on the subject of religion. We have been told that when the conversation turns to God or what happens after death or the kinds of spiritual affiliations it's important for people to have, you can change the rules of the game and you can pretend to know things you manifestly do not know and win points for this behavior. And what I'm trying to argue is that we are paying a terrible price for this double standard because it is intrinsically divisive. It breaks down human conversation. It has shattered our world into these separate moral communities where we have Christians against Muslims, against Jews. It has kept alive this claim, this ludicrous claim that one of our books was dictated by an omniscient deity, and therefore it makes sense to look at every current problem through the lens of this book, be it the Bible or the Quran. And that's the Enlightenment distinction that I'm arguing for, that we know none of our books were dictated by the creator of the universe, or we should know it, and yet we currently live in a country where 53% of the population believes the universe is 6,000 years old.
Sam, let me ask you, what do you make, then, of the fact that here we have 1966, Time magazine cover is God Dead, 2006, with Richard Schroeder asking, this, to put it in extreme terms, is the Enlightenment dead? Why that shift, Sam?
Well, we're witnessing in the U.S. a remarkable political empowerment of the religious right. I would argue that the levels of adherence to these kinds of beliefs, the percentage of the American population, for instance, that believes that the Bible is the perfect word of the creator of the universe, has not changed very much. I mean, we're not noticing a sudden upsurge in religious belief, but we're noticing a kind of visibility and public empowerment, political empowerment, that I think is troubling, because these beliefs are not well-behaved. I mean, this is not what people merely believe on Sundays, and then they go into the office Monday perfectly willing to reason in Enlightenment terms. I mean, these beliefs are operative in the public sphere. They, as Richard pointed out, they affect the kinds of medical research we do. We don't fund stem cell research at the federal level because of what people believe about the human soul and its entry into the embryo at the moment of conception.
Sam, Richard, I wish you'd stand by for just a moment. I want to welcome one more voice onto this panel from Princeton, New Jersey. We're joined by George Kateb. He's professor emeritus of politics at Princeton, author of Patriotism and Other Mistakes, The Inner Ocean, Individualism and Democratic Culture. George Kateb, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for asking me.
So here we are at this unexpected point, maybe, in 2006, where people are asking if the Enlightenment still has legs. And we find ourselves wondering sometimes, is it baked so deep in our culture that reason and all the rest are now a permanent feature of the way we approach the world? Or is a real retreat possible, in your view, Professor Kateb?
I don't think a real retreat from certain Enlightenment values is possible, much less desirable. I think actually that the entire history of this country and perhaps of the Western world shows a continued struggle between the wish or will to believe and the wish to get it right, to understand independently of any revelation or authoritative pronouncement. I expect the struggle to go on indefinitely. Sometimes it'll be more aggravated than at other times. And in certain societies, the struggle seems to have been ended, at least temporarily, in favor of the Enlightenment, as, for example, in Scandinavia and perhaps a few other societies as well. But in the United States, a place given to the lack of inhibition. People strain and struggle to come to terms with their lives, and they often find it useful to be assisted, by religious belief. I expect this to go on for as long as there is a United States. Yes, go ahead.
And do you see the resurgence of religious faith and church attendance and all the rest, profession of faith in the last couple of decades, as within the historical realm of ebb and flow on this front? Or do you see something more profound, a more profound turning of our back, or at least part of our back, on Enlightenment values?
That's a good question, and I would have hoped it easy to answer. I find it hard to answer. One thing we can say fairly readily, the present Bush administration has given a great impetus to the energies of religion in this country, especially Protestant religion, but to some lesser extent Catholic religion as well. I don't deny that. In comparison, say, to Nixon or George Herbert Walker Bush, we are not living in a society quite as secular as it once was. But I don't mean to be too old in my answer to your question, too jaded or too cynical.
Meaning what?
Meaning I don't think we should take what is happening at any given moment as definitive of the long-term future. Who knows what will happen? No one can say. That we are somewhat more religious in our public face than we once were, I think, is undeniable. Who knows what will happen even 2 or 3 or 4 years from now.
Richard Schwader, in exactly those terms, what about the midterm elections? There's been a lot of talk about the sort of retreat of the religious right, kind of voluntary retreat to some degree, and maybe beaten back at the polls as well. Does that stand in opposition to your assertion that it's the Enlightenment story that's in trouble if there's a political setback last month on the religious right?
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to have a discussion about the future of religion turn on how you feel about fanatic groups or the religious right in the United States. The impulse that I'm talking about, I think, is a near universal and has always been there. And namely, what is it? What are we going to mean by religion? Well, I don't mean the old man in the sky pulling the strings image. That made me a spontaneous atheist when I was about 8 years old. And over the years, based on research I do in a Hindu temple town in India, based on my own experience, based on my reading of philosophy, I've come to retreat from that kind of atheism and understand that the source of a religious sensibility has much more to do with people's questions about where does free will, value, and creative intelligence come from. And religion, in my view, is an attempt to theorize and understand that. The God term is hardly transparent. It's frustratingly ambiguous. But it seems to me when you look at it carefully and thoughtful people thinking about it, what they're talking about is what is the source of my free will? What's the source of my sense that there are objective values that connect me to something divine? Where does creative intelligence come from? And the atheistic critique often marches into a kind of materialism in which it's very hard to understand how free will could be anything else but an illusion, how there could be objective values other than people just deciding something's of value, which makes them totally subjective and often self-interested, and has no way of explaining creativity because there's a deterministic view of the universe. Religion stands as a way of theorizing that very deep universal intuition of our own agency. And that's not going to go away. It has nothing to do with midterm elections. To say get rid of religion because we don't like the politics of some fanatical group. I mentioned James Madison. He said, you know, without air, we wouldn't have destructive fires. Obviously, you don't get rid of air. Okay. Similarly, there are destructive things that would happen when groups are in conflict. You don't solve that by getting rid of groups. Mm.
Sam Harris, you know, we don't want to have the old debate again and again. And yet that frame comes on very quickly here. Is it possible that in our long muddle through on all of this, we've come to a point where Richard Schwader's right, where there are things that just can't be understood through a kind of Enlightenment-style rational process, and so we're, you know, looping back round to a dependence on religion? Or do you reject that out of hand?
Well, there's nothing about atheism or about scientific naturalism that rules out the possibility of mystery in principle. I mean, most scientists think we're not going to arrive at a perfectly complete understanding of the universe. And no atheist is committed to having such an understanding in hand in order to reject the dogmatism of religious people. And I would not deny that people have spiritual experiences. There's this range of human experience that we call spiritual or mystical or contemplative that is very interesting and that links up in some interesting way to our ethical intuitions. And we should explore all of this. The crucial question for me is it ever necessary or respectable or redeeming to lie to yourself and to lie to other human beings about what you know about the universe? And I would say it isn't, and that it is always intrinsically divisive to do so. Dogmatism is intrinsically divisive. And if you want to go into a cave and meditate for a year and come out having changed your mind in some radical and interesting and useful way, as many contemplatives have done for over the millennia, you can do that very much in the spirit of science without pretending to know things you do not know, certainly without pretending to know that one of your books was dictated by the creator of the universe or that certain people were born of virgins or will be coming back to judge the world in the future. I mean, there is there you can uncouple the the richness of religious experience and contemplative experience from dogmatism. And that is the challenge for us in the 21st century. We have to shed divisive and unjustifiable Iron Age beliefs that are really reliably balkanizing our world, and then have an honest discussion about ethics and spiritual experience in 21st century terms.
Sam Harris, you speak softly, but you take a big stick to a lot of doctrine right there. I want to begin to bring our listeners in, if I may. We're joined by Richard Schwader, Sam Harris, and George Kateb. Right now, Tom is calling from Foster, Rhode Island. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi there. Yeah, as I've been listening, I want to actually decided to change my point a little bit.
Okay.
Is to like to make a case for the moderates in the world. You know, what I'm reminded of was when quantum mechanics first made an appearance in the world, Albert Einstein fiercely fought against it, saying God does not roll dice.
Right.
He's one of the great scientists of the world. He's a very religious man. I'm a scientist. I know a number of scientists. Many of them go to church. This is not a problem for science. Science seeks to describe the universe. They don't necessarily ask, at least natural sciences, who or what created it, and they're actually very comfortable with that.
And when you say Albert Einstein was a very religious man, that's in quite broad terms, however, right? I mean,
broad terms, but in a sense that he's willing to vigorously fight a theory of physics, which so far, actually, he was wrong about, based on his religious principles, I think is a pretty bold statement.
So you think we should continue to have it both ways and be comfortable with that? The kind of Nick Kristof column in the Times last week saying, let's have a truce here. Let's not fight over this so much.
Well, I mean, let's talk about evolution versus intelligent design. To me, that's the best example. We have data that shows that evolution occurs. Okay, that's why diseases mutate. But at the same time, nobody says anything about who created the process of evolution. So it seems to me perfectly reasonable that the two can coexist, and most reasonable people that I talk to tend to support that.
And that's when life was a little more, harmonious, when a lot of people felt that way. George Kateb, how about it? For social harmony, if nothing else, do we need to get back to that kind of attitude of live and let live? There's a little of both in here, or is that part of the veil of illusion Sam Harris is talking about?
Well, again, you ask a hard question. I don't think a phrase like social harmony, however, carries sufficient gravity, importance, to use it as a standard for what any one of us in particular should subscribe to. This is a tough country. It has withstood ferocious fights about belief and unbelief, and I expect that it will continue to do so. So no, not for the sake of social harmony. I'm very sympathetic to Sam Harris's emphasis on, though I'm now using my phrase, growing up and trying not to engage in wishful thinking. One of the great founders of the Enlightenment is Immanuel Kant. In his essay, What is Enlightenment? In effect, his answer was, Enlightenment is the ability to throw off immaturity and think for yourself. Now, we can't all do that all the time, but I think where I would disagree with Professor Schwader is that his tone in his defense of religion and his critique of the Enlightenment is not the tone that I think the best, which is to say, like Schwader, I certainly want to understand what is going on. I want to try to understand as powerfully as I could what draws people to religion, the consolations it offers, the meaning it confers on life, the limits it may impose on our wickedness and our technological hubris. But at the same time, I know there are many disadvantages, including gullibility and intolerance and fanaticism that religion may sponsor. So I want our tone, if we're going to be engaged in thinking and speaking and writing, I want our tone not to be quite as enthusiastic as I think Schwader's tone is in defending religion as such and criticizing Enlightenment as such, but to make some distinctions. For example, I don't mean to go on indefinitely, but I noticed from the op-ed that Richard Schwader wrote that he involves himself in defending not only religion, that is to say, faith or belief, but also in tribal loyalties and group attachments. Why, but that doesn't do justice to Christianity, which is a universal and individualizing religion. It may do justice to some other religion. So let's not associate religion as such with group identity as such. That doesn't do justice to religion, it seems to me. And it confers too much on group identity, which for me is one of the greatest of all the scourges and plagues in the world.
Mm. Richard Schwader, how about it? Do you draw a line here that acknowledges the persistence of religion and its importance, but yet might wean us away from gullibility, intolerance, fanaticism, tribalism?
Well, first of all, I think wishful thinking, intolerance, fanaticism are not something that distinguish between religion and non-religion. You find fanaticism in science. You find dogma in science. One of the great books of the 20th century on science, which is Thomas Kuhn's book about scientific revolutions, is all about how reality testing is a metaphysical act. It involves dogma, and it involves logic, and it involves observation, that paradigms and schools of thought form, that people can't understand each other across different schools of thought or paradigms. I think that to treat religion as equivalent to wishful thinking and tell them to grow up is to fall into exactly the kind of Enlightenment myth-making that I'm critiquing.
I don't think I heard it dismissed whole hog as wishful thinking, but that there's this thread.
Well, let's get rid of wishful thinking to the extent that it isn't an important thing. Optimism is obviously an important thing in life, and we all know the notion that if people were totally realistic, we'd all be depressed. And that leaders, in fact, are optimistic because it helps people look towards the future with hope. But in any case, the notion of separate moral communities doesn't bother me. In fact, it seems to me that is what we should embrace and accept in the world. Separate moral communities need not fight with each other. It is the missionary universalizing impulse that I associate with some Enlightenment thinking that I think is part of the problem. And there are secular versions of it that go on in the world right now, as well as there are religious versions. I'm opposed to universalizing missionary efforts. I think they're a problem. I also think that to attribute to other people incredible beliefs, as I think Sam does often, and I think much of the Enlightenment, there's a strain in Enlightenment of attributing unbelievable beliefs to the outsider or the other, is a kind of aggressive act. And anthropology is built around trying to engage in interpretive generosity so that you actually understand what other people are about before you ridicule or mock them or lampoon them. The 6,000-year-old issue is an interesting one. It was mentioned by Sam.
Of the earth, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can be more specific. It's October 23rd, 4004 BC, as postulated by Archbishop Usher, James Usher, in 1650.
Yeah.
Now, Usher was a critical scholar who did a lot of historical research and tried to arrive at an estimate. He's obviously wrong. He was doing the best he could at the time. We know a lot better now. Critical reason obviously should play a part in that discussion. There may be some people who hang on to that dogmatically, but religion has no investment particularly. There's no association between holding on to that particular number. And in the late 19th century, Lord Kelvin, the great physicist and astrophysicist of his day, had a young Earth theory calculated in his way, which made Darwin impossible. And Darwin wasn't prepared to accept the evidence of Lord Kelvin and give up his theory of evolution because it looked like the Earth wasn't old enough.
We're joined by Sam Harris, author of the new bestseller Letter to a Christian Nation. Richard Schwader is here of the University of Chicago, and George Kateb, professor emeritus of politics at Princeton University, author of Patriotism and Other Mistakes most recently. Lots of listeners want to join this conversation. I want to turn to Sherry in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Sherry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to call this as probably, I think, the most critical discussion on the planet right now.
Mm.
And I want to make a distinction between religion and spirituality. And my distinction would be that spirituality is the personal search for truth, that everybody has that thing in them that wants to know what's really happening. And that's opposed to religion, which is organized and fear-based. And I think
why shouldn't that be a distinction between religion and science? If it's truth you're looking for, why spirituality at all?
Well, I just think everybody has that something in them that wants to know the truth, including the scientists. And I don't think that spirituality or God and science are in any way separate. Although, like some of your guests have said, we are. May never come to the total, you know, science may never find God in their science per se,
So you want to add a third pole in a way. Don't just make it religion versus science, but leave room for something else we'll call spirituality and draw it over here at the side.
Yeah, or just the search for the truth. But I think that everybody in the world is doing what they think is right according to their model of the world, and so the discussion really does have to continue about why we're here and what is the purpose. And most religions have decided that they have the only answer, which makes them better than everyone else. If we get rid of the notion of better than, then I think we can all continue our search.
So Sherry votes for seeking, but puts it in a spiritual envelope at some point. Sam, what do you make of that? Are you willing to put a kind of a third compass point here? Or does Sherry's spiritual search sound like just a kind of modern gloss on religion to you?
Well, I think we just have to be very clear about what our terms mean and be clear when dogma is creeping into the conversation. I mean, for instance, you know, if a Christian prays to Jesus and therefore kicks alcoholism, it seems to me rather obvious that the best interpretation of that is not the unique divinity of Jesus Christ, because he need only look to his right and left and notice that Buddhists and even atheists are able to achieve sobriety in their lives. So there's a deeper principle, and people transform their lives. They can be alcoholics and then they can cease to be. There is a role for certain kinds of thoughts and intentions. And then in a more esoteric sense, there is an experience people have in mystical or contemplative terms that we can talk about in 21st century terms that are informed by a growing science of neurology. We can talk about the biochemistry of spiritual experience. We can be honest about what we know about cosmology. I mean, for instance, one caller called in and said that scientists don't know how the universe came into being.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. We don't know, and we don't, and we do not pretend to know. Not even the cosmologists pretend to know, and they're the people focusing on the question. And yet religious people with their books come in and say, actually, we do know how the universe came into being. It was God that spoke it into being. Now, that is actually the height of arrogance. I mean, one of the ironies here is that religious people are always chastising atheists and scientists for being arrogant in ruling out God. But really what science and secularism and atheism is saying on the point of the creation of the universe is we do not know, and we shouldn't pretend to know. And in fact, nothing turns on our knowing at this moment. We can still find reasons to wake up and love other human beings and to seek happiness in this world without pretending to know how and why the universe came into being.
Sam, let me ask you. Sherry says, look, this is one of the most important conversations we have to have. We've got to sort this out. George Kadeb says he's sympathetic to your view, but he also expresses a kind of confidence in the sturdiness of Enlightenment values, more confidence than you've expressed here today. So I guess it comes again. Do you really see those in deep and significant trouble, or are they now so baked into our culture that we can have this conversation, but we're going to go on being fairly reasonable, fairly scientifically driven, whatever book we read or wherever we sit on Sunday or Friday or Saturday?
Well, there are certainly reasons to be confident. I mean, George brought up Scandinavia, and I think if you look to Scandinavia, you see a level of secularism and a shul of religious dogmatism that it would be currently unthinkable in the United States. I mean, something like 80% of Swedes are atheists. I mean, this is basically an inversion of the polls in the U.S., where something like 5% of us are atheists and 90% of us claim to never doubt the existence of a personal God. And so there is a reason. There's obvious evidence that the developed world, in fact, United States is an outlier in the developed world. We are virtually alone in the degree to which we conduct our national discourse under the shadow of religious literalism. So George is right that it can be done. There's no question that it can be done. The question is, can it be done here, and can it be done quickly enough here and in the Muslim world to forestall the kind of collisions we are seeing, but largely based on religious dogmatism, not entirely. Other forms of tribalism are operative. But the most depressing thing about this conversation for me is the kind of acquiescence I'm hearing from Richard Schwader, this idea that tribalism is here to stay and that religious tribalism is not all that problematic, that somehow anyone who criticizes Christians for believing that the universe is 6,000 years old or Muslims for believing in martyrdom has overlooked this great ocean of nuance that totally exculpates religion. This rests on two fallacies. One, it rests on the fallacy that religious extremism is rare and therefore inconsequential. It is not rare. And 53% of the U.S. population thinks that the universe is 6,000 years old, and 44% think Jesus is going to come back in their lifetime. These beliefs are extreme in every sense. I mean, they're extremely stupid. They're extremely worthy of disparagement. They're extremely at odds with the data. And yet, they're not extreme in the sense of being rare. And they're massively consequential. The other fallacy that is coming out in what Richard is saying is that there's this neat dividing line between religious extremism and well-behaved religious moderation, and there isn't. If you look more closely at the books, you don't find more and more reasons to be a moderate. You find reasons to be a religious maniac, quite frankly. And so these books, as long as we maintain this idea that it is justified to raise children to believe that there are all the books in the world, and then there is a magic book that can't be treated like an ordinary book. You are in every present generation held hostage in some sense to the contents of these books, and that is the fundamental thing we have to get over, because we are living in a world that has been shattered by literature. And I'm asking your listeners to imagine how strange it would be to open the New York Times today and see this. Continuous bloodletting in the Middle East between the Sunni and the Shia in Iraq. And imagine, what if that were going on over different interpretations of the plays of Shakespeare? I mean, that would be just phantasmagorically strange. And yet that is, in some sense, exactly the world we are living in.
Sam, you keep us on our toes. A lot of listeners responding. Harry's calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Harry, you're on the air.
Hi. I believe that both Mr. Swader and Harris's arguments kind of evolved into a straw man argument, because they're both characterizing the other side as a monolithic and criticizing only the most extreme views of both sides, of the Enlightenment and of religion. There's lots of moderation. I think the issue is that the moderates in religion, in the Islamic world and in the Christian world, have allowed the loudest voices to be those with extreme views. And very often that's true in the scientific community as well.
So raise the moderate flag in the middle, and it doesn't get raised often enough for you. Harry, thanks for that call. George Katib, let me turn to you for a moment here. As science comes in and illuminates more and more, I mean, we talk about soul, but then we've got neuroscience saying, well, we can understand sort of the science of what we've thought of as a soul, and it suddenly looks a lot less divine and more earthly. Does that inevitably aggravate this fissure that we're dancing around here today?
It can, until probably some great benefit to humanity comes out of a scientific discovery that a few religious people would have opposed to begin with, and then that issue gets settled for the most part. Tom, Sherry from Virginia asked a question about spirituality, and I think she was on to something. Just let me take a minute to say that there are many mysteries in life. Life as such is mysterious. The question is whether the mystery tends to become a little less if you invoke religion. My sense is that sometimes that takes what is mysterious and tries to explain it by something even more mysterious. And I think namely some religious argument. Finally, the question for me is, what is it, and this goes back to the beginnings of philosophy in ancient Greece, what is it that inspires in people a sense of wonder at the sheer fact that there is a world, that there is existence? And it seems to me the wonder is perhaps greater when you don't assume the existence of a creator who has a mind and a will and a plan, but simply say to yourself, my God, there's a world. It is so full of the most splendid as well as some of the most awful things imaginable. And it's not there for a reason, and it wasn't put there for a reason. It's just there. I think that is the source of the deepest wonder. And if it keeps the mystery intact, at least it keeps the mind thinking and going.
But that's mystery without religion.
That's mystery without religion. That's precisely for me, I think, the better way of approaching mystery than having somebody else's set of answers, which are not answers. The mystery remains. It abides. It will never be dispelled. And the brave mind lives with the mystery rather than pretending to have a solution.
But how do you see human society responding to a challenge like that as you lay it out? I mean, religion is very durable. You say the Enlightenment is sturdy. Religion is certainly sturdy.
Yes. I mean,
can you ever see religion folding its tent and saying, well, we're just going to go with general mystery? And if it won't, do we have a greater and greater tension as science lays out more and more kind of challenges to mystery as defined in religious terms?
No, religion will not fold up its tent and science will not go away, you know, except perhaps in some universal cataclysm that abolishes practically everything civilizational or even human. No, the fight will go on. It will have some moments more difficult than other moments, undeniably. My counsel is to those who take some pride in thinking for themselves. And each one of your three questioners seems to me to be a person who takes pride in his or her own independence of mind. So let us as people who teach or think or write encourage others to think for themselves and not endorse, as I'm afraid sometimes Richard Schwader does, some of the worst tendencies in life.
Am I going to get a word in here on this?
Yes, you will. let me get one more caller, Richard, then I'll turn to you. Michael's calling from Burlington, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. I very quickly have to say that the danger of belief is that when you can't argue, the only thing you can do is shout louder or use a big stick, and the Enlightenment and technology have handed believers some very big sticks indeed. My question is, how far did the Enlightenment ever really penetrate anyway? I think a lot of people didn't know science, but engaged in a sort of scientism where they said, oh, that's, you know, mysterious and I'll never understand it, but they must know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we didn't get our flying cars and moon bases, they said, oh, well, it must not be all that then.
Right. So forget it. How popular was it in the first place? Richard Schwader, how about Enlightenment's depth of penetration in the first place? Michael,
there are sort of a few things on the table here, I think, at this point, so I'm going to try and respond to at least a couple. First of all, I think that what's rather obvious to Sam is not obvious to everyone, other people, and what's of wonder to George can be thought of as a nightmare by other people, and they do, the kind of world he's imagining. And I think we have to recognize that there is this inevitable parochialism or provincialism that creeps into people's judgments of what's wondrous or of what's obvious. There's a lot of diversity on all of those issues. Secondly, the glorification or romanticization of Scandinavia, I think, is rather fascinating. Scandinavia, for a long time, was a culturally homogeneous, racially homogeneous set of societies who lectured the world on tolerance. And now when they actually have migration coming in and they're facing genuine diversity, they're not reacting well to it at all. They're reacting rather intolerantly. And it was a society in which the state had taken over many functions that are community functions in other places, like just helping your neighbor move, which you went to a bureau to apply for a help from the state. Issues about family that arise. There's a lot there that shouldn't be glorified.
What about progress? Do you say no to progress in the end, then? If the Enlightenment's out, progress was a core idea of the Enlightenment.
Progress is something I accept with regard to specific goods. Part of the issue here is the diversity of human goods. Isaiah Berlin, who is a theorist that I admire, was famous for pointing to the heterogeneity of human goods and virtues and the idea that they're inherently in conflict with each other. There's no common denominator, and I believe different traditions of value recognize that. They pick up different subsets of value, they privilege them, they build ways of life about them. One society privileges individual freedom and choice. Another privileges duty and loyalty and interdependency, and you end up having different traditions. And the idea that you could universalize any one of them and promote them everywhere produces, in my view, a kind of tyranny, a kind of totalitarianism that we ought to be worrying about.
Sam, we've just got half a minute here. Progress was part and parcel of the Enlightenment. Do you see it as an idea in trouble in the debate we've been through today?
Well, it's in trouble to hear when you hear Schwader represented. I mean, it's clearly in evidence, however. I mean, if you look at the progress of medicine, I mean, now we have an evolving discourse about human illness and human health, and there is really one type of medicine. I mean, there is Eastern medicine versus Western medicine on some questions, but we have a growing understanding of the human body and human health, and there are certain things that are not up for grabs anymore, and people are no longer being diagnosed by the good doctors of the church with demonic possession or having suffered the evil eye. And so this is how the scope of religious dogmatism erodes based on a further understanding, a real understanding of what's going on.
That's as far as we'll get today. Sam Harris, author of Letter to a Christian Nation, George Katib, Richard Schwader, thanks to each of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.